This week on the show, we'll be covering various interesting things that have been happening in the last couple of weeks and so and days. The NetBSD release 10.0, for example, the XZ backdoor everyone has been talking about. IX Systems announcements that they will put out a release of TrueNAS 13.3. Also, state of the terminal, the LibreSSL 3.8.4 and 3.9.1 releases, and more in this week's episode of BSD Now. BSD Now, episode 554, NetBSD double digit, recorded on, where did the date go?
The 4th.
It's mixed in there. Okay, recorded on the 3rd of April, 2024. This episode of BSD Now is brought to you by Tarsnap. Go to tarsnap.com/BSDnow to find online backup for truly paranoid people. And if you want to support this show in one way or the other, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/BSDnow, and we thank you in advance for that. Hi, I'm your host, Benedikt Reuschling.
And I'm Jason Tubner.
Yeah, welcome. We just caught up a little bit since last time we spoke. Jason is back from holiday, and
yes, I went.
Tom, on the other hand, is taking a break
today.
Yeah,
he's having a bit of a break. But yeah, I've just got back from Japan. But if you want to hear more about that tour and Benedict's upcoming Japanese tour, you should become a Patreon supporter, because there's bonus content now in Patreon for our supporters there. So, you know, do check it out and get on the good juice that we have on the pre-show.
Oh, yeah. Supporter or not, we have headlines for everyone, and this one is ruffling a lot of feathers in the, well, do penguins have feathers? Yes, I think. So people were affected by, more or less, the XZ backdoor, and that's what we covered today in the headlines.
Yes, so there is a couple of links that we have in the show notes around XZ. I'm going to sort of just jump around in some of the notes that we've got here, which is rehashing of the XZ utility. So from a general point of view with XZ and BSD, BSDs aren't affected by XZ. There was, like, I'll go into each individual one shortly about their disclosure statement to the community to see where they are. But basically the gist of it is that there was multiple things here that were impacted. So there was XZ and the LZMA component, which is required to interlock the systemd and OpenSSH components. So this is not, you might have seen a few bits and pieces where OpenSSH was, a backdoored, it's not being backdoored as part of the piece of software. So OpenSSH and OpenSSH Portable weren't impacted by this directly. It was some of the chaining of events that were required to actually get to that point. So you had your XZ and LibLZMA for that to hook into systemd. And then there was other parts of the compile process that checked particular architectures, so looking for the x86 architecture and being Linux, to be able to pull this off. So from a BSD point of view, we weren't affected. Ports weren't affected. And even if it did build, you weren't a target in this instance. But this is a good reminder that this is how these chaining events work to be able to get backdoors into systems. So it was by sheer coincidence that we actually got through this without being scathed. So, you need to be running a distro using glibc for iFunk. You also need to have versions 5.6.0 and 5.6.1 of XZ or LibLZMA installed. XZ utils provided the libraries and LibLZMA. It's likely only true if you're running a rolling release distro and updating rigorously. So from my investigations, it was really Fedora 40 beta and Rawhide and people that were testing Fedora 41 as it starts its development phase, and other things like rolling distros like Tumbleweed from OpenSUSE and Arch Linux. So they were basically the ones that were in the firing line here. The typical long-term support distributions for Linux, like your Red Hat Enterprise Linux, your Alma Linuxes, which are derivatives, and so on and so forth, they weren't impacted because they're running a very, very old version. So the payload. So let's go through the payload here. If conditions check, the payload is injected into the source tree. We have not analyzed this payload in detail, but here are the main things we know. The payload activities, if the running program has the process name /user/bin/sshd, systems that put sshd in the /user/bin or another folder may or may not be vulnerable. It may activate in other scenarios too, possibly even unrelated to SSH. We don't entirely know the payload is intended to do. We are investigating. Successful exploitation does not generate any logs. Vanilla upstream OpenSSH isn't affected unless one of the dependencies links lib-lzma. Leonard Ponitoring has mentioned that it may happen via PAM lib-se-linux lib-lzma and possibly in other cases too, but lib-se-linux does not link to lib-lzma. It turns out the confusion was because of an old downstream-only patch in Fedora and a stale dependency in the RPM spec, which persisted long beyond its removal. PAM modules are loaded too late in the process AFAIK. For this to work, another possible example was PAM fprintd. A solar designer raised this issue as well on an OSS security. The payload is loaded into SSH indirectly. SSHD is often patched to support systemd notify, so that other services can start when SSHD is running. Lib-lzma is loaded because it's depended on by other parts of libsystemd. This is not the fault of systemd, it's more unfortunate. The patches that most distributions use is available here, and there's a link to the OpenSSH portable #375 commit. Update. The OpenSSH developers are looking at adding non-library integration of the systemd notify protocol, which would mean distributions would no longer be patching in libsystemd support. If the payload is loaded in OpenSSHD, the RSA public decrypt function will be redirected into a malicious implementation. We have observed that the malicious implementation can be used to bypass authentication. Filippo Valsolda has shared analysis indicating that the attacker must supply a key which is verified by the payload, and then the attacker input is passed to system, giving the remote code execution. There's further detail. It's quite interesting, and a lot of these documents are being updated on the fly. I've no doubt it's been updated overnight while I've been asleep, but I highly suggest looking at the two links that we've got that do a rundown, full rundown, and everything that we know in regards to this attack. But just moving on to the different projects, so I'm going to read out the statements that have come out from the applicable projects or the associated security officers with those projects. For NetBSD, a statement on backdoor in XZ library. Recently, a backdoor was discovered in the XZ compression library. XZ lib-lzma are included as part of NetBSD and used by the project for distribution of new releases and packages. The version of XZ shipped in all stable and unstable versions of NetBSD predates any code changes by the author of the backdoor. NetBSD is therefore safe and unaffected by the recent discoveries. It is believed that the attack only targets Linux glibc, but checking this allowed us to rule out any other attempts at compromising the library by the author. The version of XZ shipped in package source, however, is affected. Using XZ from package source is a non-default setting on NetBSD and requires explicit opt-in. Most users of NetBSD will not install XZ from package source because the version from base is preferred. However, users of package source on other platforms will need to take precautions. Regardless of NetBSD being affected or not, the discovery of the backdoor is a wake-up call and further discussion will be happening internally over how to proceed. Moving on to the FreeBSD announcement over on the FreeBSD security mailing list. Comes from Gordon Tetlow, the security officer at FreeBSD. FreeBSD is not affected by the recently announced backdoor included in the 5.6.0 and 5.6.1 XZ releases. All supported FreeBSD releases include versions of XZ that predate the affected releases. The main, stable 14 and stable 13 branches do include the affected version 5.6.0, but the backdoor components were excluded from the vendor import. Additionally, FreeBSD does not use the upstream's build tooling, which was a required part of the attack. Lastly, the attack specifically targeted x86-64 Linux systems using glibc. The FreeBSD ports collection does not include xzlib-lzma. And then there's the reference to the open wall discovery and notification. And signed by Gordon Tetlow. Over on OpenBSD, so OpenBSD does not have XZ in base, so it was not affected. However, just a brief discussion happened over on the mail list. It comes from our friend Peter N. Hamstein. While this issue does not, in fact, affect OpenBSD, I think it will still be of interest to OpenBSD users. A lot of us deal with Linux on our day jobs after all. This is one of the best explanations of the matter I've seen so far. And then he's got a link, which basically pushes back to what we've already about discussed. And then it leads with in, and he says, that, and it leads in with a quote to remember. This dependency existed not because of a deliberate design decision by the developers of OpenSSH, but because of kludge added by some Linux distributions to integrate the tool with the operating system's newfangled orchestration service, systemd. And further digging over on the OpenBSD ports, so looking through Archive as XZ, the last commit was 3 months ago by Natty, and it only upgraded to version 5.4.5. So basically, even ports in OpenBSD is not affected there. Which basically brings us to Dragonfly BSD. I went digging through Dragonfly BSD through the code repository. It has got XZ in the repo. However, XZ is like really old. It hasn't been touched for quite a significant amount of time in Dragonfly BSD, so I highly doubt that the code is of an issue there, and nor that it would have met the requirements to be able to be executed on that point. So that basically summarizes XZ. I highly recommend keeping reading what's going on in that space, especially, you know, a lot of us have to deal with BSD hosts in the office and also Linux hosts. So it's highly recommended to keep on top of this and keep it, you know, in the front of our minds, because, you know, this has the hallmarks of what we went through back in 2014, I think it was, with Heartbleed, and we saw LibreSSL being forked out of the OpenSSL project because of, you know, all this sort of kludge that goes into certain things which aren't required by other projects like the BSDs. So, yeah, we could see a fork of XZ, or, you know, are totally, you know, rethinking of how we do software distribution and development in the future.
Yeah, that's more general, not just focused on XZ or LZMA, but in general, like, how do we get contributions? How do we trust that? Are the people, like, in those two instances, I think the person who created the packages also signed them and published them, and it's like, let's have a second pair of eyes looking at those. And that's, I think, is the more longer discussion that a lot of projects will be doing to, in the future, prevent these kinds of injections.
Yeah, it was like, you know, it came from a blob it had to basically, during the compile process, it had to pull in a blob. So, you know, those that basically forked the code out of the XZ repository into their own trees, sanitize that code as it came in. Whereas a lot of others will just, you know, compile straight from those repositories and then build binaries directly for their distributions from those points. Mm. But during that build process, it was pulling in the malicious code. And that's where you know, people were getting, you know, hit up by this particular issue.
And then, yeah, a lot of discussions came up also, yeah, paying for critical infrastructure, things like those. Then there's other voices that say, yeah, this would still have happened even if you have paid the developers. So I think the discussions that are being made are good and they lead hopefully to something more substantial and secure for everyone. And it's good to have these discussions. It's just everyone is now a security expert and analyzes the whole thing from the beginning. And that can be kind of overwhelming if everyone starts becoming, you know, a security expert.
Yeah, we still have to have cool heads because we, you know, if we start, you know, jumping at shadows, it also causes other issues as well. So, you know, security is a whole methodology around risk and understanding risk and then making sure you do the correct risk assessments for your organization. That goes for people that build software to people that use software.
All right. Let's move on to NetBSD 10.0, or as I would call it, NetBSD X, because why not? So that has been out. Remember, previous episodes we had covered or looked at pre-releases or release candidates, but now the final release has been out since March 28 from NetBSD, their release page, and we'll be covering a couple of things that are of interest in this release and what's good to have in there and why you should upgrade. So, of course, they provide their usual introduction. So that NetBSD 10 is the 18th major release of the NetBSD operating system and has been updated from the 9.3 branch, which was originally in 2019. And of course, they provide update instructions and how to get to this. But what are the actual changes since NetBSD 9.3? So they list performance and stability here. So they have a separate link to benchmarks of NetBSD 10. Those show huge performance and stability and scalability gains, more like over NetBSD 9.x, and especially on multiprocessor and multi-core systems for compute and file system bound applications. And the areas of improvement include they switch the kernel's file path lookup cache to a faster per directory red-black tree. They improved the scheduler performance, including the ability to more appropriately spread load on a mixture of slow and fast cores, like big dot little ARM CPUs and various optimizations for the machine independent virtual memory system. They switched to a faster Radix tree algorithm in there for memory page lookups, or improved tracking of clean dirty pages, speeding up the fsync of large files by orders of magnitude, and also improved parallelization, rewritten the page allocator with awareness of CPU topology, replaced the global counters with per CPU counters, and reduced the lock contention. There's also improved performance in select and poll system calls and performance improvements in TempFS, implemented a lazy update of the A-time and M-time modification time calls, various optimizations of architecture-dependent x86 and ARCH64 code, which vastly improves network and I/O throughput on ARCH64, and various boot speed improvements also. That's performance and scalability. Security and quality assurance also got updates. Compatibility with WireGuard, so that's what a lot of people will look forward to. They have a new interface, WG, providing a VPN tunnel compatible with the WireGuard specification, and the driver is experimental still, needs more testing, but is available, and people should test it and report anything they find so that it can be fleshed out. User space implementation using a rump kernel server is also included. See the WireGuard-userspace man page. And the NetBSD implementation works with WireGuard implementations used by commercial VPN providers, Android, Linux, and more. In stronger and faster cryptography, they also added an implementation of the Adiantum. Sounds like adamantum, with a nod to, you know, the usual Marvel folks. No, ADANTM. That cipher for efficient disk encryption for CGD, the cryptographic device, on systems without AES acceleration. So that gets also a bit of a more better crypto. Added support also for shared keys with CDG config, allowing multiple derived subkeys to be used across multiple drives. And it switched the default password hashing algorithm to Argon 2ID, winner of the password hashing competition. Oh, interesting. The algorithm's hardness automatically scales with system performance. Added support for Argon 2ID to CDG config for use in password-based disk encryption. That sounds interesting. And the kernel now takes advantage of CPU acceleration and vectorization for common cryptographic algorithms on x86 and ARM, including AES and ChaCha. They also support new ARM v8, A security features, privileged access, never, which helps prevent inadvertent user space memory access by the kernel. Pointer authentication helps defend against return-oriented programming attacks on buffer overruns, and branch target identification, which limits the locations to which branch instructions can jump. They also added more sanitizers, testing capabilities, and quality assurance. And, for example, the kernel concurrent sanitizer, kernel memory sanitizer, and they have a new virtual USB host driver, which allows fuzzing and detecting bugs in USB drivers from user space, even if the hardware is unavailable to developers. That's also interesting. Okay, hardware support, because NetBSD runs on pretty much everything out there, including or starting from toasters to mainframe and everything in between. That's me, but you can get where this is going. They improved support for ARM, the SoC chips from Allwinner V3S, for example, found in the Litchi Pi Zero, ARM Logic G12 SoC, and the Apple M1 SoC support, for example, in the M1 Mac Mini that runs NetBSD now. The NXP IMX8M SoC support in Hummingbird Pulse, for example, and plenty more. Raspberry Pi 4 support, both boots NetBSD from USB with EDK 2 UEFI firmware, or copying, installed in the SD card, or copying the EDK 2 to the /boot partition. Rockchip support for Pi 64, Orange Pi, the Asus Tinker boards, plenty of stuff. Added support for booting the Raspberry Pi 0-3 in big endian mode. Added support for ACPI, collaborative processor performance control, adjustments on server-ready hardware. So all good things that you would expect from a NetBSD in multiple different architectures. They also have a bunch of new drivers. For example, the ASONG AHT20 temperature and humidity sensor, Ethernet quality of service controllers, Broadcom Genet V5 Ethernet controllers found in the Raspberry Pi 4 that is available. So plenty of other drivers. I just skip ahead a little bit. You can read the full notes, of course, from our show notes. They also improved various drivers. They synced, for example, the GPU drivers. That's what a lot of people also want to know. In the kernel with Linux 5.6, bringing lots of new hardware support for accelerated graphics. For example, the Intel via i915, NVIDIA via Novo, and AMD via AMD GPU and Radeon graphics processors. They also added Dev ACPI, a character device for accessing ACPI tables, and ACPI dump no longer requires options in secure in the kernel. Plenty of AMD chips, AMD SMN and AMD Zen temperature. So to get those sensors and support there. Added network hardware, TCP for UDP RX checksum offloading for Aquantia, gigabit Ethernet interfaces, and support for the Marvel AQC 113 10 gigabit adapter. Plenty others. Moving ahead, improving support for MIPS. Couple bootable images were provided for the Cavium Octeon MIPS 64 boards and a couple others. Improved support for vintage hardware, so for the Alpha, for the Amiga, Atari, you know, whatever you have still in your basement or right under your desk. They also have virtualization improvements as a bigger topic. Many improvements to the Zen support, added support for Zen PVH, Zen PA. V drivers under HVM guests, and also added support for jumbo frames in feature SG to parallel virtualized network interfaces. DOM0 kernels now have multiprocessor support enabled as well, and Zen kernels now use the same kernel modules as native kernels. Also have improvements in Hyper-V support that includes added support for multi-channel VM bus and HVN, added support for changing MTU and TX aggregation in HVM, and improved VLAN and IP checksum offloading support. Virtio driver enhancements they added for Virtio 1.0 and the Virtio drivers. All good things. NetBSD virtual machine monitor improvements allow the host to suspend and resume via virtual machine is running or while that running is running, and added support for RAP CMPS x86 instructions. Okay, they have a whole list of features and general improvements. For example, networking stack improvements. They, for example, implemented RFC 7048 in the kernel's network stack, relaxing rules for IPv6 neighbor discovery retransmissions. IPsec, LAG, and VEther also got updates. So plenty of good stuff. File system and storage improvements include in FSTAT, for example, they added basic ZFS support. They probably need to look later at more ZFS particulars. That's what I'm interested in. New user space programs, improvements to user space programs all around. And a couple more and extended APIs. Again, dig deeper if you're interested in some of these. And have a separate changes to system behavior and compatibility. So check those out. Probably that is something that may be not breaking something, but you should be aware of at least. And they also removed some obsolete components, like some old drivers or, for unsupported devices or devices that are really not around anymore. A whole list of third-party components like a new OpenSSL version or SSH updated to 9.6 and such. So get NetBSD, and if you're using NetBSD and want to make sure that they continue their work on the system, definitely consider a donation to the NetBSD Foundation, and thanks to everyone who worked on this release. I think that is a fine update to NetBSD.
There's a huge amount of work that's been done in the release since, was it, I think, NetBSD 9, which was in, 2019 that it came out?
Yeah, it took a couple of years to get it to where it was now,
which means
but I think it's better this way.
There's been a sizable amount of development that's happened in here, and, it crosses so many different architectures. People don't realize that, you might build something for one and then you've got a fuzzer somewhere else, Spark 64 usually shakes out a lot of bugs. And you might get something working in one and then all of a sudden it breaks over somewhere else. So, running with so many architectures, it is quite tedious to be able to get it all to boot across all platforms. So it does require a fair bit of effort.
That's just amazing work.
It is. All right. Now today over on the news roundup, our first piece of news is the TrueNAS Core 13.3 plans. We'll read through the article where open storage began. TrueNAS has come a long way and has delivered incalculable value to millions of users around the world. After nearly 20 years of evolution since its inception in 2005 as FreeNAS, TrueNAS Core has proven to be the most reliable and highest quality platform for traditional primary storage use cases. Users and customers looking for incremental fixes and changes to their stability storage platform enjoy the sustained value and maturity of TrueNAS Core. Today, we are announcing our plans to release TrueNAS Core 13.3 in the next few months. No, you didn't miss a release. We simply renumbered the 13.1 release to 13.3 to align with its updated FreeBSD 13.3 operating system. At IX Systems, we have worked hard for many years to be the best possible corporate sponsors for open source projects. Unlike proprietary vendors, our processes and planning are done in the open, and both community members and customers alike play an important role in how TrueNAS continues to evolve. Both FreeNAS and TrueNAS Core were originally developed using FreeBSD as their underlying OS. Roughly 5 years ago, IX Systems began its Linux journey with the introduction of TrueNAS Scale. This expanded its potential community, broadened and simplified the support for the latest hardware, and opened the door for new possibilities for the software. TrueNAS equals Core plus Scale. It's only natural that some community members have expressed concerns about the future when there are two versions of their favorite storage platform. However, as TrueNAS continues to grow, we believe that its future is not a zero-sum game. Both TrueNAS Core and TrueNAS Scale will exist to address the needs of different users. The focus of TrueNAS Core continues to be ensuring storage reliability, stability, and security for existing users. Taking into account its macro lifecycle, TrueNAS Core is now entering a sustaining engineering phase within the TrueNAS project. It is not anywhere near its end of life cycle phase. We are just going through a new release cycle for Core, and users can expect to receive maintenance updates for many years to come. TrueNAS Scale is the software edition where new features and updated components are actively developed and tested. This is natural because of the bulk of the open source innovation we rely on is created and supported on Linux first. Therefore, developing a version of TrueNAS on Linux enables us to more rapidly deliver a more feature-rich, stable, and easier-to-use storage product for users and customers alike. This includes the ability for TrueNAS to run on a much wider variety of hardware and configurations. Of course, high-priority security and bug fixes are all good candidates to be backported to TrueNAS Core, and TrueNAS Core users will always have the ability to side grade to Scale if and when they're ready. For TrueNAS Enterprise customers, you will always be fully supported for the duration of your support contract regardless of the software version you are using. TrueNAS 23.10 already ships by default on some enterprise products like the TrueNAS F series. If your organization is considering a side grade to the Scale-based software now or in the future, as many customers already have, please contact IX System Support so we can assist you in the decision-making and upgrading process. TrueNAS Core 13.3 is coming soon. The release candidate for the next version of TrueNAS Core 13.3 is planned for May, followed by its formal release in June 2024. TrueNAS Core 13.3 will include the following updates: FreeBSD 13.3, OpenZFS 2.2.3, Samba v4.19, updates to Smart, Network UPS Tools, which is NUT, and other services, and various security and bug fixes. TrueNAS Core 13.3 will continue to receive bug fixes related to stability and security. These updates will ensure that 13.3 is a reliable platform for both home lab and enterprise customers, as well as a staging version for those who wish to migrate to Scale at a later date. TrueNAS and FreeBSD continue. With our 25-plus year history in open source software, we share an uncommon affinity for FreeBSD among all those in the community who love TrueNAS. After all, FreeBSD is a major part of the company's heritage, IX Systems having spawned from BSDi in the 90s. The TrueNAS development and engineering team continue to provide contributions upstream to FreeBSD and remains committed to the bootstrapped open source development philosophy on which it was founded. Chris Moore, SVP of Engineering at IX Systems and previous co-host on the BSD Now show, shares his thoughts with other diehard fans on this community forums post. TrueNAS Core hasn't been deprecated, and 13.3 is planned to start making a show in Q2. It will be based on FreeBSD 13.3 and provide a way of keeping running jails and upstream packages for some time to come. It is still a rock-solid NAS, and we're expecting to support it for a long while for that use case. Our love of FreeBSD is only eclipsed by our commitment to keep pace with the demands of our customers and use it to continue innovating in ways that help it find success with TrueNAS. TrueNAS Core will provide a rock-solid foundation for users that need fast, reliable, and scalable storage. TrueNAS Scale provides the same rock-solid foundation, but it supports those users that want to extend their storage into a converged solution with apps and VMs. Core users that do not need apps and VMs may find that Scale offers better performance and stability, more flexible hardware support, and more intuitive UI with a wider breadth of storage-focused features. When should I migrate? If you're installing a TrueNAS, iX Systems recommends that you begin with TrueNAS Scale. There is more added functionality, vaster, broader support for hardware, catalogs of apps, better performance on most workloads, and an improved web UI, which is managing TrueNAS easier than ever. Existing TrueNAS 13.0 users who are comfortable with their TrueNAS system can update to TrueNAS 13.3 when they see a need based on the TrueNAS software status page. Upgrading from 13.0 to 13.3 will be a simple and direct process. TrueNAS 13.0 users looking for the new capabilities outlined above can side grade to TrueNAS Scale at any time, serving data and essential NAS functionalities such as SMB, NFS, iSCSI, and VMs, with the primary exception being jails. The upcoming Scale 24.04 Dragonfish will, however, include the early support for sandboxes, which provide jail-like capabilities using systemd and spawn containers. Manual migration of workloads will still be required, but sandbox functionality effectively provides the same functionality that jails provided core users. We can't wait for jails users to test and provide feedback on this new feature. And finally, the community activity. All TrueNAS processes and planning are done out in the open, and TrueNAS Core 13.3 is no exception. In addition to your input, there are also many ways TrueNAS users can give back and enrich the experience of the community. Check out how you can make a meaningful contribution and play a part in shaping the future of TrueNAS. Every contribution, big or small, plays a part in moving TrueNAS forwards. Whether you share your use case, refer a friend, create tutorials, or how-to content, and even provide code directly to the TrueNAS GitHub repository, your contribution makes a difference. And as always, thank you for being part of the TrueNAS community. So this blog post came out to heat off the discussions that were happening around the 13.1 release that didn't happen. And there was a fair bit of blowback in regards to that. So that's why we are now seeing this particular blog post, because people are quite concerned about TrueNAS's direction into the Linux space and moving away from its core foundations, where OpenZFS in FreeBSD has been rock solid, and a lot more rock solid than it has been in Linux in the past. And the discontinuation of TrueNAS at 13 or any future lines is quite concerning to a lot of people that do have a lot of infrastructure out there and don't wish to go to Linux for particular reasons. Which brings us to a fork of TrueNAS, and that is known as Zvolt or Zvolt, depending on which part of the world you are in. So under zvolt.io, you will find the new landing page for the project, and the code will be up there shortly. So that will be fork of the TrueNAS core code that will be then maintained as a fork, which is probably the best way of going about this if you want certainty moving into the future.
Yeah, and if there's news in this space, we'll definitely report this. And yeah, so this is the current state of the world as it is, but we also have something a little bit for the nostalgics among us, the state of the terminal. And I found this, we found this on gpanders.com, and this is a comparison or companion article to the talk that that person gave, Gregory, at NeoVimConf 2023. So Gregory here has been using Vim, NeoVim, as his full-time text editor for close to 10 years, spent a lot of time in the terminal and have become a very aware of the many flaws and idiosyncrasies of the bizarre platform, or that is the terminal. But they also think it gets a lot of things right. And he's not alone in this belief. Terminal-based tools are still widely popular, even in the presence of many alternatives. The Stack Overflow developer survey shows that NeoVim is the most loved editor 3 years in a row. And personal note from Benedict, yep, I've been spelunking with NeoVim in the last couple of weeks and months, and I like it very much. So, okay, back to the article. It's only been in the last couple of years that that Gregory here has begun to dig deeper into the inner workings of how terminal emulators and the applications that run inside of them really work, and learned that there is a lot of innovation and creative problem solving happening in this space, even though the underlying technology is over half a century old. So he found that many people who use terminal-based tools, including shells like Bash and editors like Vim, know very little about terminals themselves or some of the modern features and capabilities they can support. So in this article, he discussed some of the problems that terminal-based applications have historically had to deal with and what the modern solutions are, as well as some features that modern terminal emulators support that you may not be aware of. So he has a big part of the background and history. With a DEC VT100 as an image. Most terminal emulators today can directly trace their roots back to the DEC VT100. The VT100 was not the first video terminal, nor was it the last, but it was the most popular one at the time. And as we've learned from the history many times since, what becomes popular creates the de facto standard for everything that comes after. Video terminals were an improvement on the teletype machines that preceded them. They could move the cursor around the screen to create interactive interfaces. They could use color and clear and redraw the displays quickly without feeding out reams of paper. So that's already quite green back in the day. Different video terminals had their own unique way of doing things using unique proprietary escape codes, a sequence of bytes beginning with an escape 0x1b character, which made life difficult for applications because they had to know which of these sequences to use. Libraries and helper programs like TermCap were created to help ameliorate these issues, and we still live with the descendant of these early libraries like TermInfo. Eventually, formal standards were created such as ECMA 48 and ANSI X3.64, from which the term ANSI escape codes derives, which defines a set of standard escape sequences. The DEC VT100 was the first video terminal to support these new standards. Its popularity combined with the new standards meant that programs now had a set of known good escape sequences they could reliably use. Its popularity spawned many clones, which in turn supported the same sequences for compatibility and application. The graphical window system, window, not Windows, even though it fits in this, those eventually replaced hardware video terminals, but users still wanted to use the terminal-based programs they were accustomed to. You know, those VI people out there. In 1984, work began on a software terminal emulator at MIT. This emulator became part of the X project and was named Xterm. Xterm implemented its own features, which did not exist in the video terminals it emulated, such as the mouse tracking and a configurable color palette. These features were in turn copied by Xterm clones until eventually Xterm itself became the new de facto standards, or the standard. So then there's a section on terminal emulator basics. Terminal-based applications write two kinds of data to the terminal emulator: printable text that is displayed to the user, and control codes, which modify the terminal emulator state. Control codes are either single bytes in the C0 character set, like bytes 0x00 through 0x1f, or sequences of bytes that begin with the escape character 0x1b. These sequences are most commonly referred to as escape sequences, and it's these sequences that do the bulk of the heavy lifting in terminal applications. Going a little bit further, so they describe what they do, and some of those particular ones, like the prefix escape CSI sequence in this category, are those which reposition the cursor, change the cursor style, clear the screen, set foreground and background colors, and more. The OSC sequences, on the other hand, are those which begin with the prefix escape closing bracket and are typically used for things that modify or interact with the user's environment outside of the terminal emulator itself. Hence the name operating system command, OSC. Examples are reading from or writing to the system clipboard, changing the title of the terminal emulator's window, or sending desktop notifications. And they talk a little bit more about what that entails and how you could emulate those, like creating colored printfs and such. Problem and solutions. Terminal emulators are descended from old legacy technologies, which brings with it its fair share of problems. Many of these problems have been mostly solved or at least ameliorated, while others are still active and or active areas of innovation and research. For example, key encoding. Terminal emulators and terminal applications communicate through a stream of bytes. When a user presses a key, the terminal sends the byte presentation of the character associated with that key. The old video terminals only supported ASCII, so this was generally fairly straightforward. Modifier keys like Control and Alt complicate the situation. Alt modifies keys, or Alt modified keys are encoded by prefixing the character with an escape, but this has a problem. Including extra escape byte at the Alt modifier introduces ambiguity between Alt modified key presses and two separate key presses. When an application sees escape C, should it interpret it as Alt C, or did the user press escape and then press C? Applications usually solve this by measuring the amount of time between escape and the next character. If the time is less than some defined interval, it is considered an Alt modified key press. BIM uses the tTimeOutLen option. Tmux uses the escape-time option. And so control modified keys are an even bigger problem. When control is used as a modifier, the shifted version of the key has the 7th bit masked off. For example, C is 0x43, and after masking the 7th bit, the byte becomes 0x03. This means that not only can the shift modifier not be used in conjunction with control, but that certain control modified keys are completely indistinguishable from other control codes. It goes on a little bit with decoration because of the X term supporting 256 user-specified colors and more. Then they have a section on capability determination, like terminal emulators do not all support the same features and what that entails, as well as system integration and some other peculiarities. So they conclude with, while it's true that terminals as an application platform are idiosyncratic and quirky, their portability, ubiquity, and relative ease of use for application authors makes them increasingly popular for many developers, even in the face of an increasing number of alternatives. So this article is not exhaustive, but it's not meant to be. There are other challenges that both terminal emulator and terminal application authors face that are not discussed here, as well as other areas of innovation and creative exploration. For example, better graphemes, clustering, or synchronized output to avoid flickering in redraw-heavy UIs, and custom shaders to create arbitrary visual effects. There are always links to each of those. From the article, terminal emulators are not static. They continue to evolve and innovate to solve users' problems and improve users' experiences. The underlying technology is old, downright ancient by the standards of modern tech. But instead of a flaw, they consider it a strength. It gives them confidence that while individual terminal emulators may come and go, the underlying platform will endure.
Yeah, while it might be old, I still pine for the old technologies. I remember when I... Well, my first experience with a VT terminal was the DEC VT320 hooked up to a VAX. And the device itself is, you know, nostalgic. And I wish I still kept one. I'm sure they went out to the dumpster and then got thrown away. But I wish I did keep one because, you know, the simplistic nature of one of those terminals is, you know, you don't have all this other clutter and notifications and that sort of stuff. You can just focus on what you're doing. And thinking back at those days, it was quite minimalistic and you know, quite Japanese. It was quite, you know, thinking back at my holidays, and sometimes I wish I had one of those terminals these days.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't need to retrain people that have already used those before. Like, if you're all running around with head-up displays in the next couple of years, people need to be trained to use those if that's the next thing. But if you are familiar with one technology, it's fairly difficult to adapt to a new one.
Not so.
So yeah, terminal typing it is. Especially in our Unix geek area.
Yep.
As they are so used to this, this is just becoming the standard, or has already been.
Yeah. And finally, on the news roundup, it is getting close to OpenBSD 7.5 release, which usually sees a rush of releases of the subset tooling that's incorporated inside OpenBSD, and LibreSSL is no different. So LibreSSL 3.8.4 and 3.9.1 released. This is a post over on the OpenBSD journal by Peter and M. Hanstein, and it comes from a commit to the announcements list from Brent Cook. We have released LibreSSL 3.8.4 and 3.9.1, which will be arriving in the LibreSSL directory of your local OpenBSD mirror soon. LibreSSL 3.9.1 is the first stable release of the 3.9.x branch and will also be available with OpenBSD 7.5. Notable inclusions are portable changes, updated the test with expiring certificates, CET-related build fixes for Windows and Mac OS targets, update libTLS linker script to include libSSL and libcrypto. The LibreSSL project continues improvement of the code base to reflect modern, safe programming practices. We welcome feedback and improvements from this broader community. Thanks to all the contributors that have helped make this release possible. And finally, on the journal notes is, as it says in the announcement, this, the 3.9 branch, is the code that will be in the upcoming 7.5 OpenBSD release.
BSD Now is sponsored by Tarsnap. Everyone needs backups, and Tarsnap ensures that your backups are not only safe, but also secure. Your data is encrypted on your device before being sent to the cloud, so that only you have the ability to read your data. Tarsnap takes your data and works out what data is duplicated so that bandwidth can be saved. It then assembles your data into compressed blocks, encrypts them with your local private key that never leaves your system, and then uploads those encrypted blocks to the cloud. So even if someone is able to obtain your backed up data in the cloud, they will not be able to decrypt it and access your files. Tarsnap is easy to use. If you can use Tar, then you can use Tarsnap. Tarsnap is prepaid, so you never have to worry about an unexpected bill. Tarsnap is fully open source, allowing you to inspect the code to make sure that it does what we say it does. Tarsnap also does bug bounties if you find errors in the code. With clients on all major platforms, there's no excuse to not have good backups. Go to tarsnap.com to learn more. We get feedback, and sometimes we have enough that we will create a section in this episode. No, sometimes we have individual feedback, and this particular one got us before or right after we recorded, and we were like, yeah, it would take too long before we answered in the episode, so we just hit reply in our email clients and do that, and Jason did that. And so Derek asked this first question.
Yeah.
And I guess...
So, yeah. Yeah, so Derek reached out to ask about NetBSD security advisory. Security ones always pique my interest. So I was no problems with jumping on the bandwagon with this and digging a little bit deeper here. So the email goes, hey, firstly, let me say that I love your podcast. Thanks, Derek. It's good to hear great feedback like that. Thank you. Would it be possible for you guys to have a more thorough look at the latest NetBSD security advisory, specifically NetBSD SA2024-001, to shed some light on it? It seems that the risk is slightly bigger than it initially looks. Best, Derek. So over on the NetBSD security advisories page, it's got it listed. So I'm going to read out the abstract and technical details and then just go into a brief summarization of my view on the particular issue. So the abstract reads, UTEMP Update 8 is a helper program which allows users to update their UTEMPX entries, and identified vulnerability reveals the inadequate validation of user-supplied data, enabling malicious entries to inject arbitrary information. The technical details. The issue allows malicious users to inject arbitrary data into UTEMPX database due to the absence of proper filters for provided host names. The behavior can be exploited by the attacker to force tools which display host names from new TepperX databases such as US, W, and Who to unexpectedly inject escape sequences into terminals of users invoking the program. While this vulnerability does not pose a direct threat to the system's core operations, it can be leveraged indirectly to disrupt accurate system logging, compromise terminal interfaces, and facilitate social engineering attacks by displaying arbitrary content in the terminals of unsuspecting victims. The UTEMP Update 8 utility was fixed by introducing a filter which accepts only printable characters in the host name. Solutions are workarounds, so I won't go too much into the detail here, but briefly, it requires you to update your source tree and then go into the UTEMP update directory and then make the clean dir depend all and then make install. So what that does is basically updates UTEMP update and ensures that it's in place on your system and ready to go. It's not a kernel update, so it won't actually require your system to be restarted. So highly recommend just doing that as soon as possible. So my response to Derek, so I'll just summarize the notes that I've sent to him. So just summarizing the response that I've given Derek, while there's no direct threat to system internals through this vulnerability, it's highly advisable to patch as soon as possible. You don't need an outage window, so no reboot is required. This is not a vulnerability that can be compromised remotely, so has to be executed by a person that has an account or physical access to the system. There is potential for secrets, and I quote secrets there, a compromise if you're able to compromise the user's terminal on the multi-user system. If the host is of high value and connected to a SIEM, which is a security incident event monitoring system, and there is the potential for an adversary to compromise the logging output and to hide further exploit activities on the host. There is the potential for an attacker to use the exploit in making a user think that they are logged into a different machine and obtain credentials or information for other machines to perform lateral movement within the environment. So briefly, there are ways to leverage this issue that are beyond what I've just listed above to chain attacks together. My advice is to not hesitate to apply these patches. Unless there is a CVE raised for these sorts of issues, it's down to the project security officer to determine their severity. For end users, each need to do a security assessment to determine the risk to their organization. If this impacted me or the organization I worked for, I'd have these patched and deployed as soon as the fix was released.
Yeah, that's a good, nice summary. And I hope that answers the question. And next one is nicely covering what I have been going through recently and mentioned on the show. My Nextcloud installation, and Ben has written to us about it. And this goes like this. Hello, BSD Now team. There was the question from Benedict regarding Nextcloud installation guide. I have followed the one from Samuel Dowling and had it with the perfect entry. And had with it the perfect entry into the world of FreeBSD jails. There is even a guide to install a reverse proxy that was perfect to get other services external and internal available. And the link is provided, of course. Thank you for that. And he thanks us all for our work. Hey, thank you, Ben. I Googled a lot of tutorials, but this one is new to me, so I will definitely check it out. And I'm still on my journey towards a privately hosted Nextcloud at this point, going through various options. I guess I will probably go either with a dedicated server or keeping it all at home on a little Raspberry Pi and with external storage, of course. But having the setup instructions and knowing what is involved or like comparing different setup, like what people are setting or what kind of options they leave out or what kind of particularities they have in the security space, that is good to have and to compare. And I will definitely dig deeper into the link you provided.
You're getting overwhelmed by the amount of links.
That too, yeah. It's a big setup, but of course you always start from the very basic, you know, the operating system needs to be secure, and then on top comes the actual application. And of course, you can follow 1,000 guides, and we had plenty of those on the show in the previous episodes, of course. But at one point, you have to say, okay, I just sit down and just do it and then see how far I get and then go deeper where I get stuck.
Yeah, you can always just spin up, you know, a test one to sort of get an idea of how you want to do it and then pull it down and set it up again. And I think Alan Jude used to recommend, you know, you don't know how you want to set it up. So the easiest way is to set it up, write your notes, and then pull it all down again and set it all back up again based on your notes, and then see what you've missed, and then, you know, make your notes to enhance your installation and strip it down again and do it again. So
quick and dirty before fast and elegant.
That's right.
Or slow and elegant.
Hey, and then at least you got documentation to accompany your installation. So you know if something breaks or you need to rebuild it again, you can just go off that documentation.
Yeah, or put my notes later into a FreeBSD Journal article or somewhere else on my own blog if I will pull up that same stunt.
You add to the side project. The many, many links of how to install Nextcloud on FreeBSD out there.
Yeah, but it's definitely good to have that information and not just having to abstract from Linux, the path is this, and in BSD it needs to be user local, of course. But generally, what kind of settings are necessary, what kind of files to visit and make changes into, that's definitely good to have. So thanks for this submission. If you want to submit either things of your own or links that you found, feedback, show topics, or anything we should cover, send this to feedback@bsdnow.tv. This is the way to reach us via email. We also have a Telegram channel, bsdnow, of course, t.me/bsdnow, it's called. And we have a quite lively community in there. Sometimes there's quiet, but sometimes, especially in this XK or XZ case, there was a bit of a discussion going back and all good things. So if you're interested in that, check that out. And Jason already mentioned our Patreon. It's patreon.com/bsdnow, where you can dip in a little bit of money into our virtual tip jar. And other than that, I think we've reached the end of this episode. Of course, thank you for listening. And what else do we have? Nothing, I guess.
No. That's it. That's okay. The end of the show.
Then, yeah, that's the show. And yeah, have a good week. And until next week, where you have another fresh episode of BSD Now.
Thanks, everyone.